Conference Number 18, 9 a.m., September 27th, 1985. Father Hugo.
I remind you today of our schedule. Refresh your memory. We will have two conferences this morning as usual. This afternoon we will have one conference at 2 o'clock. We will have the Sacrament of Penance or Reconciliation at 3:30 for those who desire it. There will be three confessors available. Father Edward Farina, will you kindly stand, Father Farina? He will be in the sacristy where we vest. Father Farina is a pastor, a longtime friend of this retreat. His brother was my partner when we started these retreats. And he will have have confessions in the sacristy. Then the two-parters. We have two-parters. One on the right as you enter, and one on the left as you enter the building. As you exit us from the building, that reverses. So on the left as you go out, Father Wickman will you stand, Father? He's a priest from a nearby parish, and he will be there. And then I will be in the parlor on the right as you go out. That's the parlor just opposite the stairway that we use down to the dining room. There's a parlor there. There are some showcases in it with relics. And so don't be afraid to come in. I'm not going to try to sell you anything. And you can go to confession there, or I guess in all cases you can either confess or you have a conference with the priest. I'm sure they'll welcome either one, and that's up to you. And you can go either privately behind a screen, or you can go face to face in each case. We have two other priests. I'm sorry to waste them, but we don't have two more confessionals. And so we'll have to content with that, and we'll go as long as we have clients, as long as we have penitents. So now I'd like to we're celebrating our 3 days now, our sacred triduum, the climax of our retreat. This is Good Friday, as we pointed out, and observe it as such. That doesn't mean you have to go around with a gloomy face. Cheshire says you can be serious without being sad. So you don't have to be sad. In fact, we should rejoice. We have an acclamation each day at the climax of the Mass when we speak of the Paschal mystery. We rejoice in it because Christ rose and we rise with him. We humanly regret that it's such a painful means, but we nevertheless rejoice in the results. So it's a happy day. That's why we call it Good Friday. Did you ever notice that's a very odd name to celebrate the day of the crucifixion of the Lord and Savior? But it's Good Friday, good in its results. Even for God, because this is the way he recovers the human race from loss, and certainly for us. So it should be a cheerful day, but it's a day in which we contemplate the cross. That's why I put up this picture here for you to see. This is the face of Christ in the Holy Shroud. And I don't have a time to stop and explain it. I hope it's been much in publicity lately, and the last couple of years, in fact. It's been on television. It's been in the theater. And I hope you've seen some of this, and there's several books on it. that it's not guaranteed 100% authentic, but it's about 99 and 99/10 percent guaranteed authentic, as the portrait of Christ on as he died, as he wished to be remembered. Most of our portraits of Christ are disgraceful, if I may be pardoned the word. They represent him as an absolute weakling, one who can hardly has the strength to stand up. You wonder how he doesn't collapse. If he weren't held up by the paper, he would. We somehow take great joy in representing the meek and humble Christ that way. Do you think he could have been so weak and sustained that sufferings and crucifixion? You know, we should, not that I wish to emphasize his masculinity, but I wish to emphasize his courage and his strength and his majesty. He is the Son of God. And what he did was tremendous. The shroud gives us some idea. It's a noble countenance. You should know something about how it's made and how it comes from, but I think if you study it, it's on the cloth of the shroud, and so you can't expect it to be as perfect as a modern photograph. But the features there are beautiful, majestic, and it's the way he looked, presumably, when he died. And then the other picture over here, that's done by an artist on the wall. I hope you've noticed it. I should have pointed out to you earlier. That's Christ weeping over Jerusalem. That's a good mystery for us to contemplate. Christ weeping over the modern Jerusalem. That was done by a Pittsburgh artist. It's just a black and white drawing, but it's very good. You'll see it's a little bit difficult. It has a double perspective. But if you look at it closely, you'll see that it's a modern city. It looks made to look faintly like Jerusalem, but it's really a modern city. There are gangsters in there. There are riots. There is violence. There's a rape going on. Typical of a modern city, and Christ weeping over it. Remember that. Christ wept over Jerusalem. How often have I wished to gather your children together under my, as a hen doth gather her chickens under her wings, but you would not. You have not known the time of your visitation. I think that portrays Christ in our day as he looks down on a world gathering to destroy itself, neglecting the law of God and the will of God and the gospel completely, even the so-called Christian nation. And don't forget that Russia was a Catholic nation for thousands of years. It was one of the great Catholic nations of the world. And many of the people there are still deeply Christian. It has not been exterminated, despite all their efforts. But this is the world today. That book we're reading gives you an awful picture, if you'll take it as a picture of the Age of Enlightenment, the space age, with all our progress, that such things could happen, such demonic evil, sponsored by the leaders of the people, and more to come. So, when I went to the city of Florence and I visited the museum there of Fra Angelico, he was the great painter, probably the greatest religious painter that ever lived. And I found that the museum was the monastery in which he lived, and he had painted murals on every wall for his brother friars where they lived. They were Dominicans. And each one had his own mystery of Christ, painted on a masterpiece. Of course, he wasn't aware that he knew they were good, but they weren't aware that they were masterpieces, each one. And each one had his own one to contemplate. Let us say the Jesus found in the temple, or Jesus preaching on the Sermon on the Mount. And that was the particular mystery that each friar was supposed to take to himself. And the novices, they had only one. They had the same one in each room, the crucifixion. They were to learn at the feet of Jesus crucified. Now, I think the mystery of our age is that one there, Christ weeping over Jerusalem. That we come to what we proudly complain, boast, is the climax of human civilization. And it's a civilization which is violent and undermined by violence and crime. So these are for your meditation as we spend our Good Friday together. Now, that's all the announcements. We'll begin with the prayer, and we'll go back to our consideration of the Paschal mystery and the folly of the cross. We haven't explained in detail the folly of the cross yet. It was indicated in our liturgy this morning, but we'll speak of it now. Now, our prayer. It's a responsory prayer, and we'll take as a responsory prayer that great psalm, that great penitential psalm, "Out of the depths I call to you, O Lord." That will be the response. "From the depths I call you, Lord.
From the depths I call you, Lord.
Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my voice in supplication. From the depths I call you, Lord. If you, O Lord, laid bare our guilt, who could stand it? But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be revered. From the depths I call you, Lord. I trust in the Lord. My soul trusts in his word. My soul waits for the Lord. More than sentinels wait for the dawn. Let Israel wait for the Lord. For with the Lord is kindness, and with him is plenteous redemption. He will redeem Israel from all their iniquities. From the depths I call you, Lord." And let us make it that way. From the depths we call upon God's mercy and help in this day, and for ourselves personally, and for the world in which we live. Now, to recapitulate, we spoke of the Paschal mystery, the death and the resurrection of Jesus. We haven't spoke much of the event, but we came to the climax just before he died, and we contemplated and meditated upon, and again we heard them in song this morning. Sister Cecilia very nicely took our pattern for her choice of the grain of wheat. It's something that one might pass over in that pious coma very easily. We hear it once in a while at a funeral. We hear it on the Feast of Martyrs. But it's not generally to realize that we're all involved in that grain of wheat, the living as well as the deceased. This is an explanation of the Christian life. Unless the grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains just a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. That's the means whereby the transformation takes place in our lives. We are all, first of all, Christ is a grain of wheat, and we are a grain of wheat. And let me remind you, too, that the grain of wheat is flawless, faultless. And this is why it's such a good symbol of Christ, because he dies although he's good and faultless. He's pointing out to us that we as Christians must learn to die not only to evil, not only to give up mortal sin, but to die even to what is good in us. And we, whenever it applies to us, God is looking at the good in us, not our sinfulness. The martyr, Maximilian Kolb, or the other martyrs that we've considered, you see, they die to themselves. They die completely. It's not they give up sin. They give up their total selves to God. And they have to die in order to And I don't mean the physical death. Even before they died physically, they died. They were living already a martyrdom. Like we say of Christ, his whole life was a cross and a martyrdom. It just didn't start at the cross. That's what the imitation of Christ is. His whole life was a cross and a martyrdom. And so these people, too, their whole lives were a cross and a martyrdom, leading up to it, to their final death. So we have to die to what is good, not only to what is evil. And this is the explanation, too, of a religious life. We pointed out last night that they die. And a religious, whenever they die and they take their vows, they're not pledging to give up evil. That's taken for granted. They're pledging to give up life, poverty. They'll give up the good things of the world. That they're not going to live for these things, that they're going to cut their use to a minimum, but not to live for them. They're giving up the good things. We give up marriage not because sex can be evil, or because we believe that sex is evil, or because we believe the body is evil, but we give up the supreme sacramental good of marriage. And it's a human good too. We shouldn't look at something and see only the evil possibilities of it. We should see the good possibilities of it. And it has immensely good possibilities. As I said, all the beautiful things in our life came from the the wedlock of our own parents. And so we give up not an evil thing in marriage, we give up a good thing. The sublime, the most perfect of the samples, the sweetest of the samples, the most sublime of the samples. Reminds us of our union with God. And the same way, when they make a vow of obedience, it's giving up the will. That's our most precious possession. It's the key to our personality. So, the cross calls us to give up what is good, not merely what is evil. That's all taken for granted. This is what we never can learn. This is what we call this reductionism. We pivot our Christian lives around the giving up of evil, but it's also the giving up of good. And the grain of wheat illustrates that. Now let's go back to the grain of wheat, because it has a story. The whole story is there. Jesus turns and tells us that we too are grains of wheat. Where the teacher is, there so should be the disciple. And he gives us that law, that the law of the cross, in one phrase, one sentence: who loves his life loses it, who hates his life for my sake keeps it unto life eternal. We would call that a koan, or a mantra, or a paradox. It's the paradox of Christianity. It is repeated 6 times in the Gospels. 2 in St. Matthew, 2 in St. Luke, 1 in St. Mark, and 1 in St. John. It summarizes the whole Paschal mystery. Who loves his life loses it, who hates his life. And I explained last night how we hate our lives. In what sense that is understood, like an Albert Schweitzer, or like the religious. The original religious, and down through the age, it's putting them as nothing, hating them in that sense, and giving them up for God. A martyr. Or the religious vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, I give these as examples. I know I'm talking mostly to lay people. It just applies much to you as to them. They give us dramatic illustrations of it that we can understand. But this grain of wheat applies to all Christians. You are all grains of wheat, and you must die in order to produce fruit spiritually. Not only dying to what is evil in you, evil impulses or sins, to die even to your good desires. I guess we can focus on that, the dying to our natural desires, so that we can rise to our desire and our love of God and God's people. This is where we want to. Now, you'll notice, let me take the farmer. The farmer is a good illustration. You'll find, in the book that I intend to give you, you'll find a picture of the farmer showing wheat. That's a good a good illustration of the Christian life. Because we are supposed, we should go through life sowing good things in order to reap in eternity. You sow what is good and you reap what is holy. You reap more. Now the farmer sows only good seed. He would waste his time to sow disease seed. He throws it away. If a farmer was out sowing seed and somebody was unacquainted with plant life, vegetation, would watch him, he would wonder, what is he throwing that away for? We take it for granted, we know. But suppose somebody, a Mars, E.T., would come down here, and he would see the farmer sowing seed, and he'd say, hey, boss, what's the matter? Don't you want that stuff? And the farmer would say, of course I want it. I want more of it. Well, then why are you throwing it away? See? If E.T. thinks logically, he'd say, well, that's crazy. It's silly. That's the folly of the cross, to throw something away in order to get more of it. But that's exactly what the farmer's doing. He's apparently throwing it away, but he's taking advantage of the law of life. The law of life is life comes from death. Life comes from the dying seed. Dying and we live. And what Jesus does is to observe this phenomenon of nature, and he applies it to the spiritual life. He applies it to our careers as Christians. We are caught in that law too. In order to live, we must die. We must die even before we undergo physical death. We must die in our love for the good things of life, this life, in order to reap the good things of heaven, the heavenly life. Now the farmer goes out and he sows the seed. He could be at home eating cake made by his wife out of those grains of wheat. Or he put those grains of wheat up on a shelf there in jars and bring his friends in to admire them. He says, this is my prize wheat. I raised this with great care and with great difficulty. But as long as they sit on a shelf like that, they'll never produce any wheat, any bread. You see? But he could use them to make bread, and he could sit at home and enjoy the cake and the bread that is made by his wife, sit by the fireplace all winter. But no, instead of that, he's out conditioning the ground, getting ready to plant the grain again. He knows the law of nature. Unless he plants that grain, why, he will not be able to get a crop. And he is working for a crop. He goes out and he plants the grain, and he might be working on a day like this out there in the garden, not a very pleasant day. But he's whistling as he works. How could he be so perverse to whistle on an ugly day? Because he's looking forward to the crop. And this is the secret of Christian joy. This is why a Maximilian Kolb could sing when he was lying in his grave. See, he had the secret. He knew. This, we have to die in order to live. And we must learn that secret too. This is the deepest secret of Christianity. We are dealing here now with the very center and heart of our religion. And it's one which is obscured and hardly anybody knows. Jesus says that, seeing they do not see and hearing they do not understand. And it's all as simple as the grain of wheat. And this is why a Christian should be joyful. Not because he shouldn't eat, drink, and make good cheer. That's what people mean, say, well, why are you preaching this? Christianity is a joyful religion. Of course it's joyful. But it's a deep and interior and permanent joy. Not the joy of eating and drinking, which is over in an instant. It's a true joy that can exist even amid suffering and difficulty and ordeals. That's the kind of joy that Jesus promised. Not as the world gives peace, he says, do I give peace. It's different. A different order of things. And so we must imitate the farmer. Even in trials and difficulty, we work singing in our hearts. make singing and making melody in our hearts to the Lord, says St. Paul. And you see, it's crazy. That's the folly of the cross. And this is the kind of a life that we're invited to live. Now, our problem is, we'll suppose that you are lay people and you're not, don't have vows. You're married or will be married, or at any rate you're in a situation where you don't take these vows, but you're a Christian and you're a fervent Christian. How can you sow? How can you die? How can you live this mystical death that we spoke of? Because that's what we mean, to live now as a mystical death. And still to live what would outwardly be a normal life, not to run away from your problems, not to run away from your difficulties, in fact, all the more zealously and cheerfully to face your difficulties, like the farmer singing, whistling as he works. But nevertheless, to sow, how can we work that out, those who live in the world and have all kinds of worldly duties and burdens, always handling material things, always taking care of the flesh, like a mother with an infant, completely absorbed in the bodily welfare of those children. How can she raise her heart, lift up her heart? How can she sow the things of this world? But now, as always, St. Paul comes to our help. And he makes it practical and concrete. And so he will follow him. We'll turn to his second letter to the Corinthians. And where we were before, but we'll go on a little further to chapters 8 and 9, and we'll learn something interesting, the second letter to the Corinthians. St. Paul had a conflict, you recall, with the other apostles, because the other apostles were Jews, and the Jews were narrow-nationalist, and they didn't at first get the idea that this religion was for the pagans, too. Oh, they did take one or two pagans, one family, Cornelius and his family, and who was a pagan formerly, but they didn't get the idea that they were supposed to go out systematically and teach the pagans. The first one that got that idea was Paul in his conversion. And that's why he became the apostle of the Gentiles. So there was a conflict between Paul and the other apostles, even a conflict between Paul and St. Peter over this. But finally, Paul was cleared, and he went forth to preach to the Gentiles. But when he went, he was reminded that the Jews the Christians in religion were in Jerusalem were being persecuted. And he was asked, therefore, when he would go into these Gentile cities, that he would take up a collection and for the poor in Jerusalem. And Paul agreed. This was the first parish announcement of a collection, church-wide. Not the last, but the first. And he was told how that he should do that, and he did it. Wherever he went, he took up a collection, and he personally delivered it back to Jerusalem as a token of his obedience and his good faith and his desire to work with his brethren. After his second apostolic journey, he did that. Now we have something of a record of that collection here in the second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 8 and 9. How he carried out that commission. How is Paul to raise that money? Now, the great apostle of the Gentiles becomes a fundraiser as well as a preacher. The first Christian fundraiser. He has a task now to help a starving population Not just a few odds and ends of gifts, but something big. And so these two chapters tell how he did it. He didn't do it in a modern way. He didn't have bingo signs painted. He didn't plant a parish festival. He didn't buy any windmills or other such things that they use, roller coasters or merry-go-rounds or all these things. No parish dinners. No cards, no gambling, nothing like that. He went back to the doctrine of the sowing. How he knew it, how he learned it, we don't know. He was trained as a Christian. He was not a city man. It would not have occurred to him as it occurred to Jesus, who was a peasant. Whenever St. Paul looked for an image to illustrate his teaching, he usually went to the athletic field that was so prominent in Roman life at that time. But in this case, he goes to the farmyard theology like Jesus did. And this, well, surely he knew those words of St. John. Surely they had been passed on. Remember, the scriptures hadn't been written yet. You didn't go and pick up a book and read it. It was all learned by tradition, by word of mouth, and by memory. And that was the only means that they had, the only recourse. St. Paul was accustomed to that. That was the way the rabbis studied, and he knew that method very well. And so he undoubtedly knew this. And so at this point he goes back. And he sees in money, he sees money as a seed that can be sown in charity and reaped in the kingdom of heaven. And that was how he, the principle on which he based his fundraising. He gave the church a fundraising plan which has not been used since, practically, or used very little. It would be unfair for Jesus to give us a church that needs material things, churches and schools and institutions for the caring of the poor and the needed, without some means of getting money. And he gave it to us. A divine method, a method of faith. You sow in order to reap. And that was the way he appealed to the people of the cities that he visited. He taught them the doctrine of the sowing. And he taught them that just as you sow seeds in order to get a crop, you can sow money in order to get a crop. And that's what he teaches in these two chapters. You can read them and meditate on them. It comes down to a point. And he talks in general. He's very skillful. He doesn't make the mistake that many priests and pastors make. Say, he never uses the word money. People don't like to hear that from the pulpit. He talks about generosity. He talks about gifts. But he doesn't talk about money. He talks about giving, and of course they can fill in the blanks, but he doesn't talk about money. And yet this is the first fundraising sermon that we have in Christianity, right in sacred scripture. He talks about God's generosity and how God loves a generous giver. He reminds them of all the gifts they've received from God. And then, now he comes to this, and he says, the point is this. Now he gets to the crunch of it. In chapter 9, verse 6, the point is this. He who sows sparingly will reap sparingly, and he who sows abundantly will reap abundantly. There's the secret of Christian fundraising, and it's the secret of the grain of wheat. To get, you give. In order to get more, you give. In order to reap, you must sow. And he treats money as though it were a living thing, like a seed. And then he goes on. Everyone must give according to what he has inwardly decided. Not sadly. See, our sacrifices are not to be made sadly. Not grudgingly. For God loves a cheerful giver. God can multiply his favors among you so that you may always have enough of everything and even a surplus for good works. As it is written, he scattered abroad and he gave to the poor. You see, he scattered the seed abroad and he gave to the poor. His justice endures forever, as the psalmist says. Now that was the way St. Paul did it. And that is the way that we should have been raising the money in the church. We said the other day, we have built not on the words of the gospel, but we have built. Whoever hears these words and does them builds his house on rock. Whoever hears these words and does them not build his house on sand. We've been building our house on sand, and it's collapsing all around our ears. We did not take Jesus seriously at all. We couldn't live the faith. We're like St. Peter. Whenever Jesus, you know, remember when he walked on the water and St. Peter, the apostle, saw him, and St. Peter asked he could walk out to him, come to him, and Jesus said, come. And St. Peter stepped out of the boat as though he were stepping on dry land. So confident he was and so filled with faith. And then all of a sudden, seeing the water swirling around him and the winds carrying him, he lost that faith and he sank into the waves. And he cried out, Lord, help me, I perish. And Jesus said, oh, you of little faith. That's our faith. That's a symbol of the average Catholic, the average Christian. More than the average, almost all of us, we have little faith. We resort to all these shabby means of raising money for the support of the church, for the support of our schools, and they have all failed dismally. There's only one thing that could keep up our parochial school system, that is practically heroic generosity on the part of our people. The folly of the cross. And we've lost one of the most perfect constructions, one of the most perfect edifices that ever rose in the Christian church. Because we've built on sand. So this is the way we should raise our money. You sow, and Jesus promises us even, like St. Paul, he promises God's blessings even here. Jesus says you will reap 100-fold in this life. In St. Matthew and in St. Mark, whatever you give, you'll reap 100-fold in this life. If we need money, even now, we should sow money. If we're poor, we should still sow. That's the folly of the cross. There was a great movie years ago of St. Vincent de Paul. I hope, don't know whether you ever saw it. It was one of the really great movies in the days of the art movies. It may be still available. It was in black and white. It was done in France and had one of the great French actors doing it. And it had memorable scenes in it. It was a truly great movie. If you can see it, it would still be good to see. I don't know whether they keep the films anymore because now everything's in color, but it was a truly great movie. It wasn't made by Catholics at all. It was told that the French actor that played St. Vincent de Paul was an atheist. But it was, as I say, unforgettable. And there was one scene in it where there was a famine, no, a plague in the country, and St. Vincent goes in, Monsieur Vincent, this movie was called, Monsieur Vincent, and he goes into this town, and there's a child that he finds with the plague, starving, and it's just a village, and he gathers the villagers together, and he's trying to find a home for this child. And they see the villagers all lined up there, some of them very prosperous there. And he's trying to find a home for this child immediately. It needs immediate need. And he appeals to them. And they stand there. All these are Catholics now. They stand there cold and uninterested. There's one poor widow, just like in the gospel. She already has 8 or 9 children. And she is the only one and steps forward and volunteers to take the child. See, that's typical of the gospel. And so he accepts that. And so Jesus, even those who are poor can sow, not necessarily sowing money, but sowing of her little bit that she had for another child when she had too many already to care for. And so this is the secret of divine prosperity. Sow money and you'll reap money. Sow the things of this world, you'll reap the things of this world, the things of the next world. Even this things of this world, what you need. St. Paul says, God will take care of you. You don't need to worry. He scattered and he gave to the poor. His justice endures forever. Now, this is the faith that is given to us. It's our challenge whether we're going to live it or not. And we in America have substitute business like me. I knew of a priest who resisted even the allurements of his bishop, who wanted him to start bingos. His school was failing. He wanted him to start bingos. And this priest resisted. And the bishop said to him, "Now," he said, "Father, you've got to be realistic." That's the netting. You've got to be realistic. You've got to be reasonable. You don't live by faith. You've got to be reasonable if you want to survive in this dog-eat-dog world. And we just can't, by our methods, survive in this dog-eat-dog world. But the true Christians do. So this is the challenge before us. Now, if money can be kindred of seed, then, of course, nobody loves money for itself except the miser. A miser is the only one who looks at it, you know, lovingly and counts it over and over again and just loves it just for because it's money. Most of us like money because of the wonderful things it can get for us. Buy anything with it. So if grain of wheat can stand for the money, the grain of wheat can stand also for all the goods of the world. Now here's our reason then to how we practice detachment. And how we use the good things of the world, the most profitable way to use the good things, the pleasurable things, or the pleasures of this world, is to sow them in order to reap heavenly pleasure, to sow earthly pleasures to reap heavenly pleasure, to sow earthly goods to reap heavenly goods, to sow earthly wealth in order to reap heavenly wealth. This is the challenge of our faith. This is not only the Christian way of fundraising, it's the way of getting a great harvest in heaven. And you know, at this time of the year, as we go late in the year, the church takes the cue from nature that this is harvest time or approaching harvest time. And now this, we celebrate our own harvest time. The church has this idea deeply buried in her liturgy. That's the trouble, I guess. It's buried. We don't bring it out and live it. To gain in that heavenly harvest that we're all working for. Now let's take a look at the good things of the world from this point of view, therefore, and see how they can be sown. The samples. They're the samples. Here we come to the deepest secret, the highest secret of how to handle the samples. We've already shown you how to handle the samples in this world. We handle them when we use them, when we eat and drink, we do all for the glory of God. But we can distinguish different kinds of samples. The first class of samples we'll call necessary samples. We can't sow everything. The farmer has to live. He has to be strong in order to do his work. He wants his wife and his children to support him and to help him. And so he has to provide generously for them too, that they may be healthy and strong and happy. But the farmer knows the law of life. You reap only what you sow. If you sow sparsely, you'll reap sparsely. If you want to have a great crop and reap abundantly, you must sow abundantly. And so the farmer doesn't want his family to waste any of that precious wheat that he has piled in his barns, in the wheat bins. He wants to provide for his family and his home and himself. But he wants to have a great crop. So what does he do? Well, he tells them, now you take, we'll take out what is necessary. But now don't be wasteful. Take out what you need, and we'll use that for ourselves, but the rest we will sow. Now, that's the way we should do with the good things of the world that we have. We will use what is necessary. Some people will bite even to what is necessary, like those who choose, like a Peter Morin or a Dorothy Day, to live a life of destitution. We can take what is necessary, and then we sow the rest. And that will be our harvest in the kingdom of heaven. The only things that you can take with you, says Peter Morin, are the things that you give to the poor. And that was true, you see. You sow them, by sowing them, you give them.